The Short Stories of Mark Twain. Taken from the Complete Short Stories of Mark Twain, Doubleday and Company, New York, New York, 1985. Before he began writing novels and short stories, Mark Twain, the pseudonym of Samuel Langhorne Clemens, 1835-1910, earned his living as a journalist. As a result, his short stories usually read more like slightly improbable newspaper stories than pure invention. These four stories, written between 1865 and 1897, represent a stylistic and chronological cross-section of Twain's best fiction. The Notorious Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. In compliance with the request of a friend of mine, Twain begins, I called on good-natured, garrulous old Simon Wheeler and inquired about my friend's friend, Leonidas W. Smiley. But the request for this favor was actually a ruse. In truth, Leonidas W. Smiley never existed. Rather, his friend had known that if I asked old Wheeler about Leonidas Smiley, it would remind him of his infamous Jim Smiley, and he would go to work and bore me to death with some exasperating reminiscence, as long and as tedious as it should be useless to me. If that was the design, it succeeded. This infamous Jim Smiley, it turned out, was a gambler of almost supernatural repute. He would bet on absolutely anything. Take any side of the bet. He'd wager, for example, on a cockfight, a catfight, a dogfight, or even on which of two birds would fly off a fence first. Smiley often bet, and always won, on his bullfrog, Daniel Webster. One day, Smiley bet a newcomer $40 that Daniel could jump farther than any frog in Calaveras County.
Well, said the man, I'm only a stranger here, and I ain't got no frog, but if I had a frog, I'd bet you.
Obligingly, Smiley went to catch him a frog in a nearby swamp. While he was gone, however, the stranger poured a hefty quantity of quail shot down Daniel Webster's throat. When Smiley returned with a freshly caught frog in hand, the contest began. Counting three, Smiley yelled, Git! And the new frog hopped off lively. Meanwhile, Dan'll give a heave, Wheeler recalled, and hoisted up his shoulders so like a Frenchman. But it warn't no use. He couldn't budge. He was planted as solid as a church. The stranger gladly took Smiley's money, and as he walked away, he turned and said over his shoulder, I don't see no pints about that frog that's any better than any other frog. A few moments later, when Daniel belched out a handful of quail shot, Smiley figured out what had happened, and he took out after that fella, Wheeler continued, but he never catched him. And at this point, Wheeler heard his name called and stopped in mid-sentence to go answer the summons. When he returned, he started in on another tale, one about Smiley's one-eyed yellow cow. But Twain said, lacking both time and inclination, I did not wait to hear about the afflicted cow, but took my leave. The Story of the Bad Little Boy. Once there was a bad little boy named Jim. Though, if you will notice, you will find that bad little boys are nearly always called James in your Sunday school books. But things went differently for this bad little boy from the way they usually go in Sunday school books. Jim did not have a pious mother who was dying of consumption or destined to go to her grave from anxiety over her little James' welfare. In fact, she said, if he were to break his neck, it wouldn't be much loss. Once when Jim stole the key to the pantry and ate his mother's jam, then put tar in a jar so she would not notice, a terrible feeling didn't come over him. And something didn't seem to whisper to him, is it right to disobey my mother? And then he didn't kneel down alone and promise never to be wicked anymore. No, Jim ate that jam, put the tar in the jar, and laughed. On another occasion, Jim stole the teacher's penknife. Afraid he would get caught with it, he slipped the knife in George Wilson's hat. Poor George Wilson, the moral boy, the good little boy of the village, who always obeyed his mother and never told an untruth. When the knife slipped out of George's hat, and he was about to get whipped for stealing, no one appeared to make Jim into an honest, God-fearing, upstanding, moral young man. The episode ended with a pointed but very un-Sunday school-like moral, and so the model boy George got thrashed. No, this Jim bore a charmed life. Nothing bad ever happened to him. He did not get sick or bitten by a dog when he ate too many of the farmer's stolen apples, and did not shoot off three or four fingers when he stole his father's gun and went hunting on the Sabbath. On the contrary, Jim grew up, married, raised a big family, and got wealthy through all manner of cheating and dishonest, unscrupulous means. And now he is the infernalest, wickedest scoundrel in his native village, and is universally respected and belongs to the legislature. So you see, there never was a bad James in the Sunday school books that had such a streak of luck as this sinful Jim with a charmed life. Is he living or is he dead? Twain spent the month of March, 1892, at a posh hotel on the French Riviera, and there he became acquainted with a gentleman whom he gave the anonymous name of Smith. During breakfast one morning, Smith pointed out an old, wealthy silk dealer, Théophile Magnon, from Lyon. I suppose, Twain said, that Smith would now proceed to justify the large interest which he had shown in Monsieur Magnon. But instead he dropped into a brown study for some minutes. At last Smith returned, recounting the fairy tale about a little boy who owned a beautiful songbird, which he loved very much but often neglected. Presently the bird died. Smith added, "It isn't children only who starve poets to death, and then spend enough on their funerals and monuments to have kept them alive and made them easy and comfortable." The conversation now turned into a story. As a young man, Smith reminisced, he, along with three of his friends, had spent several years trying to earn a living as artists. Despite the obvious merit of their work, no one bought their paintings. One of the group, Carl, finally hit upon a plan to improve their condition. One of the four would have to die in order to gain recognition for his work. It was a law, Carl explained, that the merit of every great unknown and neglected artist must and will be recognized, and his pictures climbed to high prices after his death. So lots were drawn, and one of the young painters, François Millet, was elected to fill his role. The other three would travel around France pretending to be Millet's students, alluding to his reputation as a master and dropping casual, ominous remarks about his impending death. At the appropriate time, Millet would indeed die. A wax dummy would be buried, and the four friends would split their earnings from Millet's enormous stock of paintings and sketches. The plan worked magnificently. They all became quite rich. "Yes, we same old four," Smith concluded, "who have lovingly shared privation together, carried the cough." "Which four?" Twain broke in. "We four." For Millet helped to carry his own coffin. "In disguise, you know. Disguised as a relative. Distant relative." After the burial, the four conspirators did not even know how to begin to spend all the money they had made. "It is a wonderful history, perfectly wonderful," Twain exclaimed. "Whatever became of Millet?" Smith replied. "Do you remember the man I called your attention to in the dining room today?" "That was François Millet, yes. For once, they didn't starve a genius to death. This songbird was not allowed to pipe out its years unheard and then be paid with the cold pomp of a big funeral. We looked out for that." A story without an end. One of the ways he found to pass the time during a recent cruise, Twain related, was by completing incomplete stories. After dinner, someone would tell a story but leave off the ending. Each member of the group then made up his own ending to everyone's delight. One story, however, defied the most ambitious and persistent efforts to arrive at a suitable ending because the original version had no ending. The fellow who told it had begun reading it 25 years earlier, but had been forced to leave it unfinished when the train on which he was riding suddenly derailed. The story follows. Jim Brown, a good-hearted, bashful, and upright Presbyterian living in Missouri, longed to marry the modest, sweet, and beautiful Miss Mary Brown. Mary's mother, who opposed the match, seemed to be wavering, so John resolved to make an ardent attempt to win her over to his cause. Donning his best white suit, complete with matching white hat, and renting the most ornate carriage and livery in town, which included an elaborately stitched lap robe, he drove out to the Brown farm. As he rode along, a gust of wind blew his hat off his head and across a mud-filled ditch. In order to present himself properly, John would have to recapture the hat. But he did not want to risk soiling his suit. So looking far down the road in either direction, he doffed his clothes, set them on the carriage, crossed the ditch, and retrieved his hat. Just as John ran for the carriage, however, the horses began easing down the road. He finally caught the carriage and mounted the seat. Quickly, he slipped on his shirt and threw the lap robe across his legs and lower torso, hoping to find a secluded spot in which to finish dressing. At last, he turned into a narrow tree-covered trail and immediately froze. Standing before him were Mary Brown, her mother, and two impeccably respectable friends of the Browns, Mrs. Taylor and her daughter. Wrapping the lap robe tightly around his nude lower body, John looked on in speechless shock. The Browns and the Taylors, it seemed, had gone to help a family whose house had burned down, and in the aftermath of the fire, they had found themselves without a conveyance to return home. John Brown's arrival seemed a godsend. But since his carriage was only a two-seater, the women spent considerable time discussing how to get all four of them back to the Browns' farm, all the while largely ignoring John. For his part, he said nothing and did not stir from his seat. At length, the older women decided that Mary should ride with John back to the farm, fetch their wagon, then return to pick them up. Just then, Mrs. Taylor told her daughter, "The evening chill will be coming on pretty soon, and those poor old burnt-out people will need some kind of covering. Take the lap robe with you, dear." The young woman stepped to the buggy and put out her hand to take John's lap robe. Thus ended the tale. Twain's companions never were able to come up with a satisfactory ending. Everyone sought a happy finale, certainly, but how to arrive at it perplexed them. At 3 a.m, the group gave up and went to bed. Meantime, Twain concluded, Mary was still reaching for the lap robe. We gave it up and decided to let her continue to reach. It is the reader's privilege to determine for himself how the thing came out.